It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Let's start off with the big headline of the day. New York Governor Mario Cuomo, not Mario, Andrew Cuomo. What am I, we got Mario on the mind. Andrew Cuomo, out. Don't care. I was never a Cuomo fan to begin with. Let's hope his replacement does some positive things for the working people of New York that Andrew didn't. Hopefully move the state forward, hopefully do some good things. I'm ready to be done with the past and move on to the future so we can actually get some stuff done. Again, back to the frame, getting things done. But I do find it interesting, very interesting, that you still got Matt Gaetz in Congress, you still got Donald Trump, who's the most favored of the GOP. I think you got to weigh which side cares about treatment in the workplace. I'm glad he's gone. Bye. It is what it is. Other big news today. The Senate, holy shnikes, did its job. Today, the Senate, I know, did its job. 69-30. Yes, you had 19 Republicans joining with all the Democrats to move forward on the $1.2 trillion investment in our nation. And it was called, aptly, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. Pretty simple. We didn't even need one of those cute little acronyms that they like to come up with. It's just the Bipartisan Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. Because I guess it's so rare that there's some bipartisanship that we can celebrate that it is there. Now, as I said, you know, this is going to hopefully move us in the direction that we start rebuilding some stuff, doing some good stuff there. I do find it interesting that yesterday's headline Reuters put out was GOP gives Trump credit for an infrastructure bill he opposes. And that is apt for today's Republican Party. Yes, this was all Donald Trump, but he's against it. Yes. He was going on the other day about how anybody who votes for this, anyone who gives Biden a win, it's over. Well, they did, and good on them. As I said, they got this through, the bipartisan part, almost immediately moving on to the other part, the $3.5 trillion human infrastructure budget plan that they're going to move forward on. I'm hoping it happens. We need investments in our environment. We need investments in housing and education and healthcare and senior care. We're getting older and older quickly, and we're going to need to do something with people as they do get older. But this bipartisan bill, some good stuff in it. Look, I mean, is it perfect? No, nothing's ever perfect. You're never getting perfect. Let's stop with the I'm only going to get perfect. Never getting perfect. You know, as I've heard said before, there's only been one person who's ever been perfect, and they nailed him to a couple of pieces of wood. Nobody's perfect. Nothing's perfect. This ain't perfect. But it's a good start. As the White House has put out a one-pager saying, look, this is going to create good jobs. It's going to good paying union jobs. They're saying around 2 million jobs per year over the next decade. As we build more stuff, as things expand, they're expecting 2 million jobs a year. Those jobs, especially the building jobs, will be done under prevailing wage law, which means local wage and hour conditions will not deteriorate. We are not going to have, you know, transient fly-by-night contractors coming in doing shoddy work and then disappearing. You're going to actually support a local construction base. I am a big fan of prevailing wage laws and project labor agreements. The hope is we get that done that way. There's also talk, according to the White House's one-pager, of growing the clean energy sector and wages in the clean energy sector, you know, wind, solar, carbon capture, energy transmission stuff, rewiring our infrastructure, you know, the whole grid. If you remember, like I do, I go back to the campaign in 92 when Jerry Brown, who was running, governor of California, was running for president. One of his platforms was to hire people to go restring every pole, every electric line in the country, they were going to restring. And the argument back then was some astronomical number, like 80% of the electricity was lost in transmission. And that if you could, you know, make that more efficient, if you could save some of that from being lost, prices might come down. We'd have an abundance of energy. It would be a smart thing. And I agree. It would be a very smart thing. Something maybe we should think about. Also, some EV charging stations on highways, in communities, in gas stations, getting people the ability to take those electric vehicles on the road. I think a smart, smart decision. Also, one of my favorite parts of the bipartisan plan is Buy American. The stuff that we're going to be rebuilding the country with, the iron, the steel, all of the manufactured products, all of the construction material, all made right here. I think that's important because while it's great having the jobs of people putting stuff together, the construction workers building the stuff, we need to have the jobs of people creating the materials to do that. And this bill does this, as we found out. Evidently, 20% of our roads, this is the number they're saying, 20% of our roads are garbage. Or as they say, in poor condition. That means about 173,000 miles of road. That's how much of that they are planning to repave and to deal with. 45,000 bridges, probably 5,000 of them right here in Pennsylvania where I'm at. So good stuff. They're also talking about making massive contributions and massive investments in transit workers and in public transit and doing the things that, we should have been doing all along. There's going to be a good bit of money for that. Going to help the auto industry out because we're going to make electric vehicles here, and they're encouraging the supply chain. You know, you remember the automobile? Remember when all the parts were made here? Remember when Delphi was a massive company? Remember when you could get a car part that didn't suck out of the box? I have a friend who does car work, and he says, half the time you take a starter out of the box, it's junk out of the box. You got to go replace it two or three times just to get something to work because of the cheap garbage we're getting out of China. So really important to have local supply chains. And one that I would argue would be maybe a little more quality minded, just a thought. Also going to invest in the areas around the country that are the energy producers, coal and gas and all of that. They're talking about $21 billion in environmental remediation. Superfund sites and brownfields, abandoned mines, those things. They're going to cap wells, all kinds of stuff to reclaim land that has been just, dumped on by the profiteers who have passed on their external costs to us, the taxpayer. And if you want to get mad about that money, get mad at corporate America. And, by the way, deregulation. That's what's done that. I'm thrilled to see that. Maybe we take some of that reclaimed land, maybe we clean it up, and we build some decent housing for people. Just a thought. Also, we're going to invest about $65 billion in our broadband access. Biden wanted $100 million. They scaled it down to $65. Can't do too much, evidently. Now, I would love to have the kind of internet speeds that other countries have, and I would love to have their prices because ours are crazy expensive. I pay more for high-speed broadband access than I've ever paid for a car payment. I mean, think about that. It's crazy. And one of my favorite ones, pipe fitters. If now's the time, call up the pipe fitters union and say, I want to be a pipe fitter because they're investing a ton of money in pipes. Whether it's the gas lines that are going underneath the ground. When I first moved to Allentown, Pennsylvania, within a couple of weeks, a house literally just blew up. Somebody was digging in the backyard, hit a gas line, just boom. Same thing. There was a nursing home, a couple months later, a nursing home around the block. Same thing. Boom, up goes this nursing home. We need to protect our gas lines a little bit better, upgrade them. That stuff hasn't been really dealt with in 100 years. Kind of time. Also, our water pipes. We need massive investment in water infrastructure. And I know, like, when I moved to the central PA area, Harrisburg was like the sinkhole capital of the world because the water lines underneath were all broken and water was just eroding the underground. And you'd see every once in a while a garbage truck get swallowed up or a bus or, you know, something. It was a lot of fun. Now we got the opportunity to upgrade and do that. But the pipes, kind of one of these moments that I go, pipes are a good idea. And it's something that I've been calling for a long time. Because I saw this story put out by the Barcelona Institute for Global Health. And according to them, bottled water is like 3,500 times more harmful for the environment than tap water. And you go, wow, that's a huge number. It's amazing. Yeah, just putting something in a bottle and shipping it across country, yeah, it's going to be worse for you. When I was a kid, you drank out of a garden hose. When I was a kid, there were drinking fountains literally everywhere. And I know some older people, they're going to tell me, yeah, they had drinking fountains, but they were one for whites and one for blacks. Right, I know. Now we can have one. Now we're big boys and girls. But we don't even have them anymore. Everything's gone to bottled water. So this study out of Spain basically says, look, you know, everything that goes into bottling water, you know, making the bottles, manufacturing the bottles and you know, shipping them to distribution, the transport, the usage, the disposal, the waste, all this stuff, 3,500 times worse than for the environment than just drinking water out of the tap. Now, they looked at the population of Barcelona and said like 60% of the people there drink bottled water. And you go, wow. So they estimated what would happen if everybody, the entire population, switched to bottled water. And what they came up with is it would cost like almost another $85 million just for the raw materials to make the bottles and all this stuff. And it would kill off almost another species in a half a year. So we don't need another. We got too many already. We need bottled water. And I'm going, you know, I remember when bottled water first hit. I go, what a dumb idea. Who in their right mind would buy water when you can get it right out of the tap? And I remember the whole push to convince you that your tap water is bad. The lead pipes that we haven't fixed. And in some areas, tap water is bad. Evidently, Americans purchase about 15 billion gallons of bottled water each and every year. In fact, it's more popular now than soda is. Soda has been plummeting. And it comes back to this mistrust because people think what they're drinking out of the bottle is better than what's in the tap. But oh no, we don't know what's in that bottled water half the time. Half the time, and this is my favorite, although two big boys, the two big names, do you know what they put in the bottled water? Tap water. You're literally buying tap water. Now they do a little filtering it because the person who sold me our filtration system at our house, he was very proud of the fact that they actually built and sold one of the big names, their filtration system. Now it's a much bigger system than mine. Same concept, but you know, obviously much bigger. It's just tap water. They're just literally taking city water, running it through a filter, putting it in a bottle, and charging you like $2-3 for it. And we're buying it up because we've been told that, you know, that tap water is bad for you. Only problem with that is in most places, the tap water is extremely regulated. It has to meet strict standards. In fact, we get... I see in the borough that we don't get city water. We still have well water. But in the borough, they tell you what's what. They tell you what the numbers are, the levels for this and that. They have to record all this stuff. Bottled water, not so much. And in fact, what they ended up finding in a lot of places, in you know, a number of the waters, and I'm thinking of a, you know, one that begins with P. It's a kind of a French name that the one report said that they actually like found fecal matter. And look, if you're drinking, you know, honestly, if you're drinking the spring water right from the spring, probably a bunch of animals go in the bathroom in there. Wouldn't be surprising. But that evidently we've taken as it's private. It must be better. And we've kind of, in this weird way, been trained like Pavlovian dogs to think anything done by the public, anything done by our government, anything done by us is somehow bad. But anything done by the profiteers, good. Except not. Now, for me, the message out of all of this, and the reason I bring this up, is because, you know, I want to do away with the bottled water. It's insane. We should ditch that immediately. We should build infrastructure across this country that makes our pipes better. We upgrade that. And we put, you know, drinking fountains everywhere like we used to have. I remember going to the park and playing basketball. And there were drinking fountains, several of them. And they were free. And you know what we used to do? Because we didn't kind of want to suck out of the same tube as everybody else. We brought our own bottles. We didn't have bottles, we just brought cups. But same idea. So use reusable bottles. You know, glass ones preferably, steel ones probably. Get away from the plastic. But rebuild the infrastructure. And oh, by the way, save yourself a ton of money. It's insane to me that we're buying water from some of these massive companies. It's amazing to me. And the guy who makes the cocoa mix, Nestle, the largest water pimp in the world. Their CEO once said that water isn't a right. Which means you should have to buy it if you want to live. And what better profit motive than I have what you need to live? It's crazy. Absolutely crazy. But like I said, I'm thrilled to see that we're going to get something. It's not perfect, not by any means, but I think going to move us in the right direction, get us started. And then, you know, hopefully we get this other half of it. Now, none of this stuff is done yet. This just got through the Senate, so I'm still happy, still guardedly optimistic that the House isn't going to tank it because we got to get the other side done too. But some good stuff so far. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Trey Crowder is going to be here to share some thoughts, the liberal redneck, on what's going on down south and around the southern area, especially around the vaccine. Quick break. Right back with Trey. Stick around.
There's nothing more American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win. On the Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1922. That was the day 1,300 workers from four railroad brotherhoods walked off the job in Joliet, Illinois, near Chicago. The walkout threatened to paralyze freight service for steel mills in nearby Gary and other regional industries. 400,000 railroad shopmen had been on strike across the country for nearly 7 weeks. Newspaper headlines that day warned a general strike of 2 million tradesmen loomed on the horizon. Brotherhood leaders promised sympathy strikes in response to threats made against their members by troops on duty at railroad centers and yards. There were also real concerns about the health and safety of trainmen, given rolling stock was no longer being maintained. In Joliet, workers stayed away under threats from troops. Additionally, Illinois Central trainmen faced threats from striking miners throughout Kentucky and Illinois who warned, "Stop transporting non-union coal or suffer the consequences." Resentment had been building up against state guard troops stationed in Illinois yards. Earlier in the week, striking shopmen had engaged in a fatal confrontation with Joliet sheriffs that left a striker and a railroad detective dead and scores injured. Riot orders were called when authorities sought to arrest striking shopmen who had stormed the home of a scab. Brotherhood workers refused to return to work unless the troops were removed. Warren Stone, president of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers, stated, quote, "We are not going to have our men shot up or beaten up or threatened by armed guards at railroad shops and yards. When the men cannot go to work without having irresponsible armed guards endangering their lives, they may go home and stay there. There will be 100 more cases soon if conditions are not changed."
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the fun continues in Florida, as evidently the Florida Department of Health and Human Services is asking for another 300 ventilators. Evidently, their COVID numbers are going through the roof. In fact, I think it was almost 60,000 new cases in the last 2 days. Another story, they've bought some new death trailers, some mobile morgues, because they're anticipating a bunch more dead people that they can't possibly deal with. And you still got the governor going, hey, we're going to be fine. We're going to tough it right out. And if you school districts, if you make those kids wear masks, we're not going to pay you. It's crazy. Just crazy what we're seeing down there. And here to share some thoughts on the insanity, I've asked Trey Crowder to come talk with us. Trey is a fabulous comedian. Also, the Liberal Net Redneck. You make sure you check out his website, TreyCrowder.com, and also his YouTube page. Trey, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Good to see you. Good to be back.
So the Sunshine State is bringing in more mobile death labs, and we need more ventilators.
Yeah, I heard you say that. You know, back in my day, a death trailer was one that got blown up by my Uncle Bubbles while trying to make meth. You know, like, this is a whole new world we live in now. Like, death trailers, that's upsetting.
But here's the thing, and this is, and I think, it, and I feel horrible that I think this way, but I don't care.
Honestly, I completely hear you, and I'm with you on that. Since the vaccines came out, and since they reached a point, which this was months ago now, they reached a point where every adult in this country who, you know, wanted one could have gotten them both by that point. In my head, I got to a place where I was like, okay, so we're good to go then. You know what I mean? Meaning, like, you've had the choice to make, and if you're rolling the dice on it, then you've done that. But the rest of us need to be able to go back to living our lives, you know, and I just can't have that much sympathy for them. But as is always the case with the world, it makes it harder to be okay with things. Cause I have children, two boys, 8 and 9 years old. And as I understand it, thanks to the Delta variant and the great state of Florida, it's not as much of a done deal as it used to be, as far as kids being safe from this thing or whatnot, which kind of changes the landscape a little bit. These people's decisions are impacting our lives, those of us who were responsible. So, you know, it makes it a little more complicated than it should be. But I hear you, though. I'm not too inclined to give a F myself.
No. Like, you saw there was the radio host down in Florida who, you know, he was a big anti-vaxxer, and on his deathbed, he's like, go get the vaccine. Well, too late, buddy.
Too late.
And good, bye. And I feel terrible. I think that, you know, some kind of karmic penalty is coming for me. Something's going to be at the end going, you shouldn't have done that. But I guess I don't care.
Yeah, but the thing is, though, you do care. Do you know what I mean? Like, the reason you don't care about that is because you do care about the general public at large and just us defeating this thing and making everyone's quality of life a little bit better. You care about that, which is why you don't care about that guy, you know? So if there is a karmic retribution waiting for you, then we're all in trouble, brother, me especially, because it's a much more malevolent force waiting for us at the end of this ride than I have been bargaining on.
That is the hope. Now, I saw your most recent video, made me laugh, as all of them do. And again, I hope folks will check out your YouTube page. You do incredible work. But you brought up this question of, you know, how would the settlers think about, you know, their kids have been dying from, you know, all kinds of diseases that could be preventable. And they look at what would they say to us?
Yeah, you think about like the pioneers and the settlers and everything, and they had to take their lives and the lives of all their loved ones in their hands to pursue this better life, you know, and traverse the continent at a time when that was really difficult to do so. And they're all getting cholera and bit by snakes and all this other stuff and just dying in droves. And I feel like they had cholera and smallpox and typhoid and tuberculosis and all this other stuff. And if you went back then and told them, I feel like if you went back then and told them, hey, in the future, we will know how to combat things like that, and we'll have very simple and efficacious measures in place to combat plagues, but a huge chunk of the population will just choose not to do it. I think all of those settlers, most of whom couldn't read, by the way, would look at you and go, are you serious right now? Why on earth would you not? Please give me that. What is this magic you have unfurled in the future, oh Time Lord? Please share it with me so that I can save my family's life with it. And why in God's name are your future people refusing to partake in this? And yeah, I think that's what they would think. And again, they're not known for their intellectual capabilities, the settlers,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, no, and neither are the people who haven't gotten the vaccine either. But the good thing, I guess if there is a good thing that, you know, there are stupid people here, but there are stupid people all over the globe. I happen to see this story from England where a bunch of anti-vaxxers stormed a BBC building. Only problem is they went to the wrong address.
No, not the anti-vaxxers. What? That doesn't sound like them to get a fundamental piece of information wrong and make a poor life choice based upon that. That can't be right, Rick. Come on.
I just had to laugh. But here's the weird thing. And you go back to what the settlers would think. You know, they didn't have Fox News. They didn't have a media culture that was going after them, feeding them BS. And my favorite story of the day came out of, you know, Business Insider came out with a story because of the Dominion voting systems lawsuit. Mm-hmm. They claimed that this OAN, this One American News, they had an expert mathematician on. They had this expert mathematician on to talk about the election, and he came up with he said the probability of Biden's victory in a country was 1/10 to an exponent so large that there's not enough stars in the universe, there aren't enough atoms in the universe to explain the number. Problem is when not pretending to be a mathematician on OAN, this guy, what he does for a living, he sets up swing sets.
Yeah, you know, I hadn't heard that particular story, and I had a feeling it might have an ending similar to the one that it had, because I was thinking, listening to it, like, you know, I could go on there and proclaim the exact opposite. You know, I saw a clip of Mike Lindell earlier from his big computer symposium he had or whatever, where he was like, he was flipping the states in real time. And literally all it was just like, I turned this state a different color, and it wasn't white, which is weird, but it's just like, I'll change this state to a different color. See, Trump won, and people are all clapping and, you know, and loving it and whatnot. And it's like anyone can say that. And see, that's the problem with this whole group of people that buy into this stuff, is it's like they're the ones who say to us, do your research, you know what I mean? And it's like watching YouTube with your mouth open ain't research, you know, like research is a whole different thing. Just say, but it goes even farther than that, because having a guy go on a network that proclaims itself to be a news network and say I'm a mathematician, and they don't clarify, oh, actually he builds swing sets, and then he says a bunch of math stuff, you know, old people are going to believe that. And that's the problem with this information. They don't think about how easy it would be for me to go on there. I can't even build swing sets, but I can make up a bunch of number stuff if I wanted to.
And that's the thing that gets me. And this is the problem with what's wrong with our media culture at this moment. Now, look, I guess they don't have the budget that Fox News has to go out and buy an actual mathematician to sell his soul and spew whatever they want. So they just grabbed a guy who makes swing sets. And that seems to be okay. I don't know where to go with that other than
no, you're right. What are we supposed to do with that? Because yes, like you said, it's like all that matters is you say the thing that the target demographic wants to hear, you know. So it doesn't matter that he's not an actual mathematician, it doesn't matter that he's a swing set doctor or whatever, he ain't even, no, he's a swing set mister, you know, whatever. But he goes on there and he says a bunch of number stuff that aligns with the type of numbers they were wanting to be presented with, and that's all that matters. Then you just go forward from there. That makes those numbers true. And that is the problem with our media today, because it really didn't. It used to be a time where like some things were true and some things were not, you know, some things happened and some things didn't, but all that's just out the window now. Yeah. So
But even the math stuff, look, I'm not a mathematician. I'll be the first one to tell you that. But when I start hearing it's 1 over 10 to the exponent so large, there aren't enough stars in the universe. See, there are only so many voters in Georgia. It's a fairly small state.
Well, that's how that see, that's why they're smart about the particular swing set man they pick out to pretend to be their number doctor, is they get one that understands that you start throwing enough purported number facts out there and people are just like, yeah, probably, you know. It's like I don't know what all them numbers mean. Again, I'm on the other side and I hear all them numbers and my eyes start to glaze over and I'm like, all right, okay, whatever. I don't even know how to begin to discredit that because of how astronomically ludicrous it sounds, you know. So it's like you gotta gussy it all up with all these things that seem like facts but are not, but they sound smart. That's the key to unlocking that whole side of things. It's like,
yep,
if you sound smart or you sound like what they think smart sounds like, you know, then you're good.
Michael Lindell. I mean, perfect example. If you scream loud enough and you point your finger enough and people are going to on that side are going to go, he must know what he's talking about.
Right. I was going to say this guy's emphatic, but they don't know what emphatic means. But yes, it's like, oh, this guy really knows what he's talking. This guy's telling it like it is. You could tell by how his finger looks when he points it and screams, you know. So like, he must be telling the truth. What kind of lunatic would do that and not be telling the truth, you know? And like, we're laughing at it, but that type of thing genuinely works on so many people. You know, like unironically, that works on them.
No, I'm with you. And what's frustrating about it is we're all being robbed blind because there was a report came out today. And hey, good on us. Congratulations for us. We now have a CEO class that makes 351 times that of the average worker. They got a 19% raise in 2020.
I was about to say, what is that up from 322,
yep,
you know, a couple months ago or whatever?
We broke 350. Hooray for us.
Yeah.
Pat on us for, you know, taking the lower wages, working in dangerous conditions. Good on us, man.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it'll be 451 times in, you know, by Christmas, you know what I mean? It'll be 603 times by the next Memorial Day. I mean, that's just what they do. Like, they just accumulate that wealth, like, and that's going to keep, as long as they keep all the people who, the as long as they keep their preponderance of people who are getting screwed over by that type of culture, as long as they're keeping them upset at made up space numbers about Trump's election results, you know, they're going to continue to get away with making more and more money off of their backs. And that's their whole deal.
And that's the thing that is insane to me, because most of the people I know who are the biggest Trump supporters, they're struggling. They really are struggling. They've been screwed by this economy. And yet they are the most ardent Trump supporters. He, the billionaire con man from New York, is their guy. That's the horse they're backing. And it makes no sense to me.
Yeah, because all that stuff is Joe Biden's fault, Rick. He just got here, but it's still his fault. That's the, like, again, it goes back to the thing we're talking about, the problem with media and disinformation. There's almost nothing you can do in the face of that. I don't want to be apocalyptic about it, but like, when the other side can just tell them what they want to hear and say, no, it isn't our fault, it's actually their fault, and they can just say whatever they want and truth doesn't matter and they're going to believe it, then what are we supposed to do?
Yeah, we're just immigrants
stuck in this position. They're going to keep believing that, you know, like they can, the other side will just take credit for whatever and their base will believe it. And here we are.
Or they're just going to blame the immigrants. You know,
that too. Yeah. I mean, apparently COVID is the immigrants' fault and not even the Chinese immigrants. Hold the, you know, the old school immigrants, the Mexican immigrants, the ones coming from down south. Yeah, I know that blows. It doesn't blow my mind. It completely tracks. It's very much par for the course. But yeah, all these governors who are making it almost illegal to not catch COVID in states like Texas and Florida and Louisiana are at the same time trying to say that it's actually illegal immigrants that are to blame for the COVID surges, while they make it illegal to make people wear masks or get vaccinated or whatever. And again, it's becoming the unofficial catchphrase of our people at this point in time, or at least this segment on the show right now, which is, what are we supposed to do with that? You know what I mean? Like, it's so, like, what do you even do? It's so far out there that, like, you can call it stupid all the live long day, which I do. That's my whole job, and it's yours too. But, like, where do we go from there, man?
Yeah, no, like, look, I had a guy who was complaining that Obama had his 60th birthday party of all vaccinated people, and they were taking temperatures and trying to do what they can do, but was posting pictures about Bike Week in Sturgis.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Basically the same thing. Obama's birthday party and Sturgis. That Venn diagram is just two completely different circles, but sure, let's try to draw that parallel.
No, yeah, it's crazy. I mean, the thing that's interesting is, you know, we make fun of the South because it's so easy to do.
It's the easiest. I know. I mean, we make it real easy, you know. I mean, first of all, just the way we say everything just makes it easy to make fun of, and that's fine. I get it. Hell, the thing is, I mean, dude, I do it too. I'll make fun of people for joke, making fun of our accent. But like, if I started to tell you a story about a real dumb person I saw on the news or something, they could be from Milwaukee. And when I got to the part of the story where I quoted that person, I would be like, yeah. And then he was like, I'd start doing it in my accent, you know? And I'm a victim of that same stereotype, and I do it. So, I mean, listen, man, I get it. We are easy.
No, just because, you know, I'm looking at where these next waves coming, the next spikes coming, and you go, we've been telling you guys, why? Right. Why do we have to go through this?
Yeah, no, I know. But it's like, but I think about, like, I made that video today talking about Greg Abbott and going in on it, but I titled it, you know, Texans Deserve Better, because I do try to remind myself, because, like, I'm from Tennessee, man. Tennessee is, like, one of the worst right now, frankly. But it's like, I know, because I'm from there, that there are so many people from there or still living there or both that are just as upset by this, more so upset by this stuff than everybody else is, you know? And I just try to keep them in mind because I know that they exist, but I don't know how they're maintaining their sanity in times like these.
No, they're good people. There are good people in the South. I've met, you know, hundreds of people that I know, good people, just surrounded by raving idiots. Liberal Redneck, make sure you check out the website, TreyCrowder.com. Make sure you get to the YouTube channel. We'll get links out on how you can do that. Trey, always fun talking with you, man. I appreciate the time.
Yeah, Rick, always a pleasure. Thanks, man. I'll see you next time.
Good stuff, man. Trey Crowder. Make sure you check out the website, TreyCrowder.com. Quick break, right back.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1931. That was the day that the Airline Pilots Association affiliated with the American Federation of Labor. The need for pilots to organize became apparent as early as the mid-1920s. The airline industry was new, and pilots often faced dangerous conditions. They were often put under pressure to fly under adverse conditions, especially if they were tasked with delivering the mail. As the Great Depression swept the country, pilots were asked to fly more and more hours for less money. The organization of pilots started off small and in secret, but soon it grew. In 1930, the union got its unofficial start, holding its first convention the following year. David Bank was elected the first president. Bank had served as a flight instructor for the U.S. Army. He then led the Bank Flying Circus, performing air shows all across the Midwest. From there, he went to work for a private airmail service. As union president, Bank established the organization's headquarters in Chicago. Over the years, as plane technology has changed, the union has fought to ensure the continued safety for the pilots.
pilot fatigue, as well as security concerns, especially after the terrorist attacks of 9/11, have also been important issues for the union. Today, the Airline Pilots Association represents more than 50,000 pilots flying for 31 airlines in the United States and Canada. Their mission statement begins with the commitment to, quote, promote and champion all aspects of aviation safety throughout all segments of the aviation community. I'm learning to fly,
bang up wings. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, still good news. I'm like 69-30 vote in the Senate. I said yesterday that I thought you'd get another vote. It was 68-29 yesterday. Goes up to 69-30. 19 Republicans coming on board. I don't think that's a bad thing. I like bipartisanship when we can get it. Is it perfect? No, but nothing ever is. But some good stuff in here to share some thoughts on what we can expect out of this. Again, caveat, if it gets through the House. How it's going to help our country and help us move forward. I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. AmericanManufacturing.org is their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it is great to be with you. And yeah, we have a small victory today, but I think it's an important one on the road to progress.
So as I said at the very beginning, holy shnikes, the Senate did its job.
Yeah, and you mentioned the 19 Republicans, and yes, this was a compromise bill. You know, Biden had originally wanted $2.2 trillion in new spending for infrastructure, broadly defined. This has $550 billion, so it's a down payment on that. I think we can get some more of that through budget reconciliation. But here's what those 19 Republicans voted for. They voted for strong labor protections in this new spending. They voted for Buy America requirements that all of the materials, and in fact, they expanded coverage to construction materials in addition to iron and steel for the first time, for the very first time, to make sure that they're American made. And they voted for $550 billion in new spending that wasn't offset fully. So that's a bit of an accomplishment, and 50 Democrats got to yes as well, from Bernie Sanders to Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema. So we got a long way to go, but to me, Biden dunked on Trump and the others a little bit, who always talked about infrastructure, but could never seal the deal. I think we're one step closer to getting there.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I was surprised at 19 Republicans. I really was. Honestly, I was surprised at 10, but 19 surprised me because, look, this is, as you said, there are a lot of labor protections in there that they're generally dead set against. There's a lot of stuff in there that, look, they want to take back to their districts and their states. I understand, but this is a major win.
Yeah. And I think one of the reasons, obviously, I don't think that many Republicans voted for it for the reasons that I just articulated, but there were other reasons why they wanted to support it. There's the broad thematic reasons, like we're falling behind in global competition, in part because we don't invest in things like infrastructure. Second, in their states, whether they're rural or urban or coastal or interior, they're facing challenges, whether it's access to broadband, or clean water systems that are old and out of date and desperately need to be replaced, or some of those 45,000 bridges nationwide that are in very poor condition, or 20% of America's highways that are in very poor condition, or our coasts, which need to be made more resilient because of all these climate change-induced superstorms that we're getting, or our electrical grid, which is very inefficient. I mean, there's a ton of reasons why I think Republicans should be for this too, because there's no Democratic roads or Republican roads or independent roads. There are roads, and this is one of the public commons. This is where the federal government does have a proper role. If you're a strict conservative, you can see that, because who else is going to fix it? It's going to be up to some level of national coordination to get that done.
Yeah, now it's been 14 years since the I-35 bridge in Minneapolis collapsed, and we were talking about, you know, we need a massive infrastructure plan back then. I mean, we were talking about this all through the Obama years, all through the former guy's years, and now it's finally going to get done. We're not going to have just infrastructure weeks with photo ops and feel-good parties, but maybe actually some actual work getting done.
Yeah, let's hope so. I mean, we obviously need to get this through a conference committee. I mean, the House of Representatives passed a very robust infrastructure bill earlier in the summer. We'll have to thread the needle here. But I do think it's possible. And part of it is because this is one of those issues, and I know you have a lot of other guests who will say this as well, where labor is aligned with a lot of business interests. And it's not because we're trying to pad the pockets of corporations or anything like that. It's because we need this work. We need this progress. We need a better infrastructure for there to be a thriving American economy, for us to be more competitive, for us to have good schools or safe drinking water. These are fundamental things that I think people expect. And so it's good to see this get through. And there is one big reason for this, Rick. And I think it honestly is Joe Biden's leadership in pressing this and having his cabinet press this day after day. Yeah. And then having some senators like Rob Portman from Ohio who wanted to get to yes on this. You got to want to get to yes on this. And he wanted to get to yes. And so I think that made this possible.
Yeah. On your point about, you know, union leaders and corporate interests and all of that. Yeah, I'm someone who, you know, who points out the flaws in corporate America all the time. But I want companies to be profitable, and not so that they can dole out money to their shareholders, but so that when I go to sit down and renegotiate a contract, I can get better wage and hours and conditions for our workers. For me, that's where the mindset is. And a big part of me says this is why we need to have something like the PRO Act to give people the ability to fight for those better wages, hours, and conditions. Now, to your point, in this legislation, still Davis-Bacon applies. I'm hoping that actually gets enforced. And I'd like to see more project labor agreements put in place to make sure that jobs get done on time, on budget, and use our dollars wisely.
Yeah, quality workers, quality materials, you end up with a durable infrastructure. There's no doubt about it. And it makes sure that the money that the federal government is spending on us is result in broadly shared prosperity. Yeah. So it's not just the contractors that are getting a cut of this, but it is broadly shared prosperity. And the jobs, and I know you know this, the construction jobs, these are good blue-collar jobs that pay well, that have good benefits. It's hard work. It takes a great deal of skill and determination and grit. But those are the types of jobs we need. And for the manufacturing jobs that are going to be supplying these materials, the structural steel, the rebar, the cement, the other sorts of construction materials that are going to go into rebuilding this infrastructure, these are the types of jobs and the types of wages that we need to grow in our country. Yeah, these are folks who do not have or do not want four-year college degrees, but they do want a better life. They want the American dream. And having investments like this is a good pathway to get there.
No, this is there's a lot of good stuff in here. But my problem is while I'm happy that this got through the Senate, I'm actually fairly surprised it did. I still see obstacles ahead.
Sure.
And looking at the obstacles ahead, clearly this $3.5 trillion plan that they just started working towards getting moving along, that's a big part of this. And if that doesn't get through, what are the chances of this not getting through and us ending up in a month or two with actually nothing?
That's a real possibility, Rick, that you might end up in some sort of a stalemate. I will say I'm a little bit more optimistic because I do think that the senators on the Democratic side who negotiated this package understand that there has to be a link here and that there has to be these other investments in our social infrastructure, in our care system, in our clean energy future that will go with this other infrastructure investment that we're seeing that I think is a modern infrastructure investment. And I think these go hand in hand. And I think that the Republicans who were part of this, you know, have open eyes as well about this. It's not like they're going to be tricked into thinking, you know, they're voting for one thing and they're going to, you know, end up with a whole lot of other spending here. I think that they're well aware of that, but they're putting the interests of their state first here, rather than Trumpism or some other philosophy, by understanding that this is going to benefit everybody.
Yeah, there's no bait and switch here. They know what they were getting into. Now, some of the comments that I've gotten from my Trump supporters or the conservative listeners are that $4.7 trillion, the 3.5 and the 1.2, that's a lot of money. It's too much money. We don't have it, Scott. My response has been, I don't even think $4.7 trillion is enough to get us where we need to go. How do you respond to this is just so much money?
Yeah, where were they in 2017, 2018, when those big tax cuts were being handed out? Or, you know, the Trump budgets all along the way had massive amounts of deficit spending in them. And the first response packages to the pandemic as well. And they were very silent about it. So it's political opportunism. And here's the thing. That was obviously about immediate relief, the COVID packages. This is about an investment in the future. So, yes, we're going to lay out perhaps $4.7 trillion in new spending. But what are we going to get? What are we going to get? We're going to get a more efficient economy. We're going to get more broadly shared prosperity. We're going to get a system of care that is modernized for the 21st century, which has lagged behind. And we're going to get returns because all of these workers, the construction workers, the care workers, the manufacturing workers, they're going to be paying taxes. They're going to be paying back into the system. And it will be a virtuous cycle of growth.
Yep.
And so I don't know what's not to like in here other than a little bit of resentment that their guy couldn't get it done.
And that's it right there. My favorite headline Reuters put out, you know, the GOP is giving Trump credit for the infrastructure bill that he actually opposed.
Yeah.
It's crazy, but you're right. It is the world that we live in. And I'm looking forward to it. I hope it happens and we get moving forward.
And infrastructure. Yeah, Trump's infrastructure plan would have put a lot of it in the hands of the private sector, which would have meant no Buy America and would have meant no project labor agreements or Davis-Bacon. So acting like you're for working people with the kind of infrastructure plan that he proposed is again, kind of like not understanding what policy he actually stood for. This is a much more Buy America, Hire America kind of policy, in a good way, I would add, coming out of Joe Biden and out of this bipartisan agreement.
A lot of good stuff. Let's hope they get through the $3.5 trillion bill and we get moving. I got a couple minutes left, and I wanted to get your thoughts and talk about the passing of AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka. I know you worked in the AFL for a couple of years. Back when I think, you know, President Trumka was then Secretary Treasurer. I wanted to, thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, Rich was one of a kind. And, you know, the first time I met him, I shared the fact that my mom's side of the family was from his neck of the woods in Pennsylvania. She was from Somerset County, not far from where he was in the family and logging and mining and the commonality there. And I worked with him to stand up the Industrial Union Council at the AFL-CIO, which is durable and is doing great things today. And I always thought, you know, my first memory of Rich was actually in a prior job way back in the early 90s when I happened to be able to go to a big march just outside of Pittsburgh during a United Mine Workers strike. And I remember being struck by the way he could speak and he could explain things clearly and draw the line of which side you're on and inspire people and motivate people. And I, I, I hold that with me. I've never, ever been able to achieve that and never will. But I admired the heck out of the guy for that. And, you know, the labor movement obviously faces incredible challenges in the years ahead, but also unbelievable opportunities. And so I'm hoping that they can build on the legacy that Rich left and do some good things.
Yeah, I mean, the movement has lost a giant. And, you know, as I said, you know, the day that he passed, you know, one of the things that I was able to share with him is he actually followed our labor history tour back in 2013. And we had a conversation around that. And, you know, like a kid, he showed me what was one of his prized possessions, which was a pin from the Ludlow Massacre of one of the people who were killed in their casket. And I remember having a long conversation around that pin and you know, what it meant. And his depth of thought was just blew me away.
Yeah. Yeah, he really was. He was authentic. And I think another thing, and look, we both got some flack for this. He got more flack than I did. But when Trump became president and asked us to serve on this manufacturing jobs initiative, I know he agreed to do it. I agreed to do it because, you know, first and foremost, you want to look for every opportunity to help working people.
Yep.
In this country. That turned off, obviously, out to be, you know, just a big joke. And we both resigned for very noble reasons. But I thought Rich was a principled guy who, yes, he is a white man from southwestern Pennsylvania, but I think he understood the needs of all working people everywhere, and brought that to policymakers and leaders wherever and whenever he could.
Yeah, you can say what you want about his leadership. I one thing I'll say is he'll be remembered as somebody who was often on the right side of history.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
He was in the right. He was on the right side when it mattered, when it was important. And I think that's something to be said about his character, and he's going to be missed. And I hope Liz Shuler, I wish her the best. We are in an interesting time right now. This is a moment for the labor movement where all hands on deck. And this was the last time, the worst time to lose someone like Rich.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And obviously he was very close to the president, and at least to date, Biden has done, I think, more for this country than any other president I've seen in modern times. Yep. And we'll look to build on that progress.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. Scott, I appreciate the time, the updates. I'm looking forward to getting this done, and we'll have you back when this gets down the road.
Can't wait, Rick. Keep up the great work.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it. Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Make sure you check out their website, americanmanufacturing.org. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1954. That was the day of the groundbreaking ceremony of what would come to be known as the greatest construction show on Earth. The show was the development of the St. Lawrence Seaway. The $1.2 billion project was a joint effort by Canada and the United States. It included the building of seven locks and widening of canals. The completed project would allow large cargo ships to travel all the way from the Atlantic Ocean to Duluth, Minnesota. It connected cities such as Chicago and Detroit to international trade routes to the east. The project also included the construction of a 3,216-foot-long hydroelectric dam. More than 22,000 engineers, carpenters, and laborers made the project possible. These workers dredged 360 million tons of materials and laid 6 million cubic yards of concrete. The massive construction project was finished in just 5 years. England's Queen Elizabeth II attended the opening ceremonies of the finished Seaway. Within the first 3 days, 168 vessels had traversed the new waterway. Jason Romano owned a trucking company that helped transport gravel to the project. He recalled, "The Seaway opened up the Great Lakes and brought ships to the heart of the country. And that is what makes this country great. The men who designed the project and worked with and under me are the unsung heroes." Jason's story, along with many other workers who made the project possible, were collected by Claire Parman in her book, The St. Lawrence Seaway and Power Project, an oral history of the greatest construction show on earth. The book was released in 2009, commemorating 50 years since the completion of the massive project.
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.